Funding for Think comes from SMU Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Is there something different about people willing to sacrifice their own possessions, comfort, or even physical safety in order to keep others out of harm's way, particularly when those others happen to be complete strangers? We all adore stories about heroes. We so adore them that they tend to strike us as almost superhuman, individuals with a unique capacity to do the right thing with no regard to what it might cost. But as my guest today has learned in her investigations into the subject, it turns out there are pretty solid explanations for why we engage in heroic behavior, and there are ways we can build our capacity for it, too. Elizabeth Svoboda is a journalist who has written for publications including Popular Science, Discovery, Psychology Today, and The New York Times. Her new book is called What Makes a Hero? The Surprising Science of Selflessness. Elizabeth, welcome to Think.
Thank you so much for having me.
For purposes of this discussion, who counts as a hero?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, different people tend to define it different ways. If you look at kind of the more classical definition, people have thought about military heroes or firefighters who are saving kids from burning buildings or things like that, essentially these situations where you're taking a really big physical risk to help somebody else without really expecting to gain from it yourself. But I would argue that the definition of a hero has been broadening and that that's actually a good thing, that we can also include people who I call social heroes who may not necessarily be putting their lives or their physical safety on the line, but are still maybe putting their comfort at risk in certain ways in order to stand for a larger principle. If you look like at somebody like Aaron Brockovich, who exposed some of the ways that PG&E was letting toxic chemicals get into the groundwater, she was somebody who was standing for an important social cause, and so I would put her in that social hero category. And in addition, I think that people who are really dedicated altruists, Mother Teresa is probably the first example that comes to many people's minds, that they deserve to be considered heroic as well, maybe in a different way. You know, perhaps they're not putting their lives at risk like members of our military are, but they really are contributing to connection in the world, to improving people's lives, and I think they need to be acknowledged for their efforts as well.
What made you want to understand the sort of makeup and the mentality of these kinds of heroes?
Well, I've done a lot of reading about people like Holocaust rescuers, other people in real life who really had put themselves on the line in a significant way. So I guess for a number of years, the question had been in the back of my mind, why do these people do what they do? Why are some people seemingly, equipped to step forward and really take a very big risk to help somebody else, whereas many of the rest of us don't do that? We might be more inclined to just stand on the sidelines and watch what other people are doing. And then, maybe on a smaller scale, why do some people dedicate their lives to volunteer efforts to helping others in that way, whereas other people maybe just stay home on weekends watching TV and aren't too concerned about what's happening to other people around them? So these questions had sort of been tumbling around in my mind for some time, and I'm based here in the Bay Area of California, and I heard about a number of different research efforts that were starting to get underway. One of them was the Center for Compassionate Altruism Research and Education at Stanford. It goes by CCARE for short, but basically looking at this question of, from a scientific perspective, where does selflessness originate in the human brain, and also are there interventions that can be tried to help people uncover their own selflessness and reach their highest selflessness potential. And at around the same time, the psychologist Phil Zimbardo in San Francisco was starting the Heroic Imagination Project with the goal of helping ordinary people to become heroes, to really highlight their heroic side. So it was sort of a matter of everything came together at once, and I started to wonder if, well, maybe there's enough here for a book about some of these larger questions about where selflessness comes from, and can we put some of the science to work in our lives if we're interested in becoming more selfless or more heroic?
Well, people may be sitting there thinking, I know the name Philip Zimbardo. Where do I know that from? And the amazing irony here is that he is an individual best known in his early career for revealing how easy it is to sort of transform ordinary, normal people into pretty savage individuals, and yet he has really turned the focus of his research around entirely.
Yes, that's right. Back in the 70s, as some of your listeners may have heard, Zimbardo was known for doing the Stanford Prison Experiment, and basically he had 24 pretty ordinary young men. They had taken psychological tests, and they were determined to be pretty normal. And he assigned 12 of these young men to be quote-unquote prisoners and another 12 to be guards. And he said, okay, guards, your job is to keep the prisoners in line, see that you do it. And prisoners, your job is to obey the guards. And he took them into some makeshift cells in the basement of this building at Stanford. And he was intending, I believe, to run the experiment for 2 weeks, just, you know, sort of a social study, see what happens, how people start to behave. But what ended up happening after just a matter of a few days was that the guards started behaving so sadistically toward the prisoners, telling them to strip and forbidding them from access to the bathroom and, you know, all these really inhumane things. And so Dr. Zimbardo ultimately decided to end the experiment early, and I think he, as much as anybody, was a little bit shaken up by how quickly this sadistic behavior had cropped up. And so after he did this experiment, many people around the world were interested in how some of these situational factors, like, you know, being in this prison environment, if you're a guard, being given license to exercise control over people in this way, can unfortunately bring out the worst in us. So he spent quite a bit of his career investigating this question of why do ordinary people behave badly in certain situations. And he actually wrote a book about it called The Lucifer Effect, about these issues exactly. And when I met with him, he told me that by the time he got to the end of writing The Lucifer Effect, he kind of had begun to weary of the dark side. He just, you know, he was getting bogged down in investigating all these aspects of the worst sides of human nature. And so he decided to make the final chapter of his book about, well, how can we resist some of these evil influences and how can we try to promote heroic behavior and celebrate heroism? And that writing that chapter started to inspire him. Well, he said to himself, well, maybe I can use some of my knowledge that I've gained over the years about situational factors to help people uncover the best in them and avoid getting into these worst-case scenarios where they behave in ways that really don't align with their consciences.
You open your book with a really remarkable story of a skydiving instructor and a novice student who have this parachute failure. Tell us what happened.
Yes, this is actually the skydiving instructor, Dave Hartsock, who's from the Houston area, and he was a very experienced skydiving instructor, had done hundreds of dives, and on one particular day, he was slated to do a tandem dive with a woman named Shirley Digert, and I believe at the time she was 54 years old. She was a little bit nervous about the whole thing. It was the first dive that she had ever done, but her son had told her, you know, Mom, this is great. You should really give it a try and live a little. So she said, okay, I'm going to go for this. And, of course, Dave, her instructor, reassured her, I've done this hundreds of times. You know, I know exactly what I'm doing. You have nothing to worry about. But unfortunately, after their free fall from the plane, something went very wrong as Dave tried to release the parachute that was going to stop their free fall so that they would just be able to drift gently to the ground. The parachute just didn't open all the way, so they were still falling too fast. And in situations like this, the instructor does have a reserve chute that can be fired in case there are any problems with the first one. But in this case, the reserve parachute got all tangled up with the first one, and they just continued to fall. And Dave knew. He told Shirley, I got to be honest with you, we're in trouble here. And Dave, at that time, like as he saw they were getting closer and closer to the ground, he made a split-second decision, which was to rotate his body in such a way that when the two of them hit the earth, his body would cushion the impact and hopefully protect hers. So he really put himself in harm's way so that he could do everything in his power to help his student. And what ended up happening when they hit the ground was that Shirley, she did have some internal injuries, but because her fall had been cushioned by Dave, she was able to recover and basically lead a pretty normal life. But unfortunately, Dave, who took the brunt of the impact, ended up being paralyzed over most of his body as a result of this decision that he made to try to protect Shirley. So this is really somebody who made one of the highest possible sacrifices for somebody else's good. And I got to meet him in person, and it was just amazing to be in his presence and to know that this man had been able to do this. And maybe even more remarkable, when I asked him, you know, if you knew exactly what was going to happen to you as a result of making this decision, would you still do the same thing? Would you still put yourself in harm's way to try to protect Shirley? And, you know, he didn't hesitate. He said, absolutely, you know, I take my responsibility to my students very seriously. Mm-hmm. And so he intended to follow through on that, and he just wouldn't have felt right about himself if he hadn't done it. So he told me that he didn't have any regrets.
And I have to imagine that that sense that he did the right thing, an amazing thing, has at least helped him derive some meaning from what is otherwise just a horrible, rotten piece of luck.
Yes, absolutely. I think that, you know, it's a great comfort to him. And I know that many people have reached out to him when they heard about his heroic deed. And, yeah, it really is meaningful to know that when it mattered the most, you were able to come through for somebody else. And even though many aspects of his life are tough, I think that helps him soldier through quite a bit.
We really love hero stories, but sometimes we make heroes out to be so superhuman that we sort of put them in a separate category and think, well, great, it's good that they're out there because that means that I can just sort of live my day-to-day life. But in fact, you discover that there's a certain element of practice to this that makes it possible for all of us to achieve things, maybe not to the nature of what Dave did, but that other people can do.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. I mean, I think when you look at some of these high-stakes situations, like the one Dave Hartsock found himself in, the right kind of situational training can be very, very important. You know, Dave could have been the most unselfish guy in the world, but if he didn't have a solid understanding of what might help his student Shirley in this kind of emergency situation, if he didn't have that knowledge, he never would have been able to come up with the solution that he did. So certainly there is a lot to be said, especially in these high-stakes physical situations, for having the right kind of advanced preparation. And you can see this if you've never had instruction CPR, for example, you probably wouldn't be able to help somebody very well if they weren't breathing. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I mean, certainly that's one of the factors that really can make a difference. And there was even a study of people who intervened in dangerous situations in real life. For instance, they might have tried to help people who were victims of armed robbery.
You know what? Let me jump in. I want you to tell the story, but we have to take a quick break. My guest is journalist Elizabeth Svoboda. Her new book is called What Makes a Hero? The Surprising Science of Selflessness. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this fall to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in global studies, creative writing, and organizational dynamics. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with journalist Elizabeth Svoboda. Her new book is called What Makes a Hero? The Surprising Science of Selflessness. Join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. And Elizabeth, before the break, you were starting to tell us about a study that looked at what ways that people sort of rehearsed for heroic acts.
Right. Well, basically what the study found is that people who did intervene, for instance, to help people who were victims of armed robberies, for instance, were more likely, as compared to bystanders, to have gone through some kind of rescue training ahead of time. So when we do have this kind of training, I think it helps us feel like we're able to help. And having that conviction can be very important, especially in a split-second scenario where you have to decide right away, am I going to do this? Am I not going to do this? You have to feel like you're prepared.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Send email to think@kera.org. And we do want to speak to you as well about your experiences with heroism and altruism. So if you've got stories to tell, we'd love to hear those as well. Talk a little bit about the fact that for a long time, people assumed that the human brain was wired like for selfishness, right? And the best we could do was to keep our baser natures in check.
Right, right. And certainly there is plenty of evidence that we behave selfishly in many different situations. But there's new brain research, especially some of these functional MRI studies where these scanners actually look at blood flow in different parts of the brain as people are carrying out various acts. So in some of these studies, they're looking at what happens inside people's brains when they decide to make a charitable donation. There was one particular study at the University of Oregon that looked at, you know, people were deciding whether to give money to this food bank. And so, okay, what's happening inside their brains? And what was found was that the nucleus accumbens, which is an area of the brain that's associated with processing pleasure, processing rewards, was very active on these scans when people were making their giving decisions. So, you know, it's interesting because in some way giving to others can feel a little bit like getting a gift yourself or, you know, unexpectedly getting a winning lottery ticket or having some kind of other pleasurable experience. And, you know, giving can still feel good according to these studies, even if it's imposed on us a little bit like taxation. The University of Oregon study looked at some situations where people were simply informed you were going to give this amount. They didn't have any choice in the matter, but they still showed some of the same pleasurable activation in their brains. So we still enjoy it, even if it might not be totally our choice.
So I suppose, again, it's making the best out of a, you know, the sort of loss of control over your own money. At least you know something good is happening with it.
Exactly. I think, you know, people are seeing the redeeming value of knowing that their money is going to a good cause. So yeah, they probably do get some satisfaction out of that.
And for some people, there's almost an addictive quality to that?
Well, I think there can be. Certainly when I've talked to, there's a researcher, Alan Lukes, who's now at Fordham University, and he did one of the initial studies showing that dedicated volunteers will often have what he calls a helper's high, like this real feeling of well-being. It almost can feel like a rush to some people when they volunteer, which, you know, to some of us, I think that comes as a little bit of a surprise because, you know, we might be inclined to think of serving at a soup kitchen as maybe not the number one activity we would choose to do on a weekend when we have free time. We might tell ourselves that we would prefer to do something else, like go to the movies or meet up with friends or whatever. But yeah, there certainly is evidence that there can be an addictive quality to it, and that's why you see some volunteers who go back to the same organizations over and over again because they enjoy the experience that they're having so much. So I think it really can be a sort of win-win situation where you love the experience that you're having helping other people, and they are getting something out of it as well.
So that causes some people to say, well, then there's no such thing as pure altruism, right? If you're gaining some kind of psychological reward. I mean, the question I'm always struck with is, does it matter? If good things are happening, does it matter if the giver feels good?
Yeah, I think that's a really important question. And it was actually a common question that I would get when I started telling people that I was working on this book. And, you know, people would respond, well, you know, there's no such thing as true altruism, right? Because we're always getting something out of it for ourselves. And yeah, oftentimes, you know, that's true. We do feel good. We might get what some economists call this warm glow type of feeling when we give, and that's what the brain studies show. And, you know, in another sense, when people donate to organizations like the ballet or like the theater, their name is going to get printed in the program, and so other people are going to see that. So there might be some aspect of, you know, I'm getting improved social standing as a result of giving, so I'm getting something out of it for myself. But for me, I guess focusing on whether altruism is true or pure or not misses the point. I think that as long as the good thing gets done, as long as the other person gets helped, it doesn't matter all that much if you're getting something good out of it as well. And in fact, it may actually be a positive thing, since if you feel good while you're giving, you're probably going to be more likely to do it again.
It's always interesting, too, to think about the influence people have when they do something generous. I wonder how, you know, that affects the people in one's circle of friends or professional circle.
Right. I mean, certainly, I think when we see those around us being generous and setting an example for us, that can inspire us to our own generosity. Looking at studies of rescuers during World War II who rescued Jewish people, often they would point to people who were role models in their lives, whether it was family members or somebody else who set a really altruistic example for them and then inspired them when they found themselves in the situation where they had to help somebody else. It really inspired them to go ahead and do that, even though they did face some degree of risk.
So you mentioned earlier about what's taking place in the brain when we do something altruistic. You actually put yourself in the hot seat for one of these tests.
I did, yeah. I participated in one of Bill Harbaugh's studies. I'm not sure if my data was actually used for any kind of published paper. I think it probably wasn't. But I was curious about this question of, you know, what kind of activation is my brain going to show? Is it going to show that I'm more of what Dr. Harbaugh called an egoist, where, you know, I don't show as much pleasurable activation in the brain when I give, or more of an altruist, where I do show pleasurable activation? Because this is a quality that he found can differ significantly from person to person. Some people do show more of this activation, and those may be the people who are more inclined to give, more inclined to be generous. So I was just curious where I fell on that scale, and he told me that I was more on the altruist side of things, so hopefully that's true. I mean, I was happy to discover that, you know, my brain gets happy when I give, and it seemed to bear out my experience in real life, too. I do love doing volunteer work. I've worked with teenagers here in San Jose, California for a number of years, and I feel like it is really fulfilling work. But yeah, I mean, this is a quality that can vary significantly from person to person, and that may explain some of the variation, like why some people are so dedicated to their volunteer causes and others really just don't care about things like that.
Is it possible to identify the percentage that is likely to be altruist versus egoist?
You know, I'm not sure if he's broken it down that way, but that's a very interesting question. We can ask him if he can do another study breaking that down, because I'm very curious as well.
Well, you know, here at the station, I think it's something like 10% of listeners make a contribution. So I'm wondering if it's 10% of people who are altruists and 90% who are not. But who knows? Everybody has their own choices to make. 1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go on the phone now and speak with Jim. Hi, Jim.
Well, thanks. Yeah, this is something that's been on my mind for years. When I was a young man, on two different occasions, I interceded in what was a pretty violent situation where someone had a knife. In both instances, I was able to disable them and or to get it, you know, stop the violence. But the one thought that went through my mind each time was that if I didn't do anything, I just couldn't stand it. And I was just curious, is that altruism or what is that?
Yeah, I mean, I think certainly that is. That's probably what some people would say is your conscience saying, you know, that you value that other person's life enough that you're willing to put yourself at risk in order to help that person. And, you know, some of us do put such a high value on human life, and it sounds like you're one of those types of people. Some of us don't, or, you know, some of us might be too afraid. So there are always a number of factors that go into it. But, you know, I always look at the person's core values, and, you know, maybe that comes from your family, or, you know, maybe it comes from an organization that people have belonged to. Often, you know, we'll see Navy veterans or people like that being especially likely to intervene. But yeah, it comes down to what are your core values and what are you willing to sacrifice to make sure that they're upheld?
That was kind of a naughty question for Charles Darwin as he thought about survival of the fittest, because it doesn't seem to make any sense that somebody like Jim would stick his neck out for someone who was not, you know, his daughter or son or grandchild. Yet we know throughout history humans have done exactly that.
Right. Yeah. And I mean, some researchers think that we do this, that we help others in the group who are not related to us, because when you have a group that's made up of cooperators, of members that get along well together, that group may actually do better, say, over time and over generations than another group where, you know, even though there might be a lot of outstanding individuals in that group, if they're aggressive toward one another and there are a lot of infighting, you know, that might actually damage their reproductive prospects. So what the thinking is that it's possible that you're sort of indirectly improving your own prospects by pitching in and contributing to the group's well-being.
And then within the animal kingdom, right, there are some examples of sort of sacrificing of individuals for the health and safety of the larger collective.
Yes. I mean, Charles Darwin was especially curious about the insect kingdom, and with bees, for example, you see a lot of worker bees that don't reproduce themselves, but kind of devote their lives to supporting the queen of the hive, basically so that she can reproduce. And I believe that Darwin came to the conclusion that, well, these workers probably, you know, have genes that are very similar to the queen's, and so, you know, by helping her pass her genes along, they're in a way passing along their own genes as well.
It's close enough.
Yeah.
My guest is journalist Elizabeth Svoboda. If you want to join us, call 1-800-933-5372. We have Pat on the line now in Grapevine. Hey, Pat.
Hi there. I was curious. I remember reading Edward O. Wilson many years ago talk about sociobiology. And he mentioned the fact that altruism was a trait that was expressed found in any civilization found throughout the world. And I was curious if you could speak to whether or not sort of the more Randian objectivists, I don't even know what it would be called, selfishness or something, has also been found sort of scientifically to be expressed in our culture or civilization as well. And I can take my comments off the air.
Thanks for your call.
Right. Well, I think certainly, I mean, there's ample evidence throughout various civilizations and throughout history that we're capable of being very selfish. I mean, you know, if you look at certain civilizations that conquered others, if you look at the many genocides throughout history, there's evidence of selfishness. There's evidence of bloodlust. But what some of this new scientific work is finding is that we are also capable of being very selfless, and in fact that there may be certain structures in our brains that predispose us to that. And so I would say there's a very wide spectrum of human behavior, and it's always going to be up to us which path we choose. I really like to to highlight the element of choice. It's not that we're predestined to be one way or the other, and we don't have any choice in it. It has to do with, as I say, what we decide to value in life. If our ultimate goal is to, you know, lord it over somebody else or have more money than the next person, that's going to determine the choices that we make in life. On the other hand, if our ultimate goal is to make purpose out of our lives by helping others have a little bit easier time of it, then that's going to impact our choices as well. So, you know, even though we have certain types of biological hardware that in some situations may cause us to be selfish and others to be selfless, ultimately the decision lies in our hands. How are we going to put the brains that we have to use? And I really wanted that to be one of the key messages of my book, that, you know, there is a lot that we can do to improve our selfless capabilities if we choose to.
And we don't have to start with, like, selling everything we own and giving it away. You write that we can basically start small and build our way up.
Right, and that's actually what Dr. Zimbardo in San Francisco sort of recommends. You know, even if you don't necessarily get a big heroic opportunity to save somebody at the scene of the Boston Marathon bombings or 9/11 or something like that, every day you have these smaller opportunities to help people around you, and it can be as basic as, like, helping somebody carry their groceries across the street, or maybe sticking up for somebody at work who you think is being bullied by the boss. And the idea is that when you practice these kind of selfless acts, you're gradually starting to get comfortable looking for what other people need and taking selfless action. Like, it starts to become almost second nature. And that then possibly, if you do ever get one of these big heroic opportunities, you're going to have this mindset where you really care about other people, you really value them, and so you might be more prepared to do what you need to do in the pressure of that moment.
My guest is journalist Elizabeth Svoboda. Her new book is called What Makes a Hero? The Surprising Science of Selflessness. Join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this fall to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in global studies, creative writing, and organizational dynamics. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with journalist Elizabeth Svoboda. Her new book is called What Makes a Hero? The Surprising Science of Selflessness. Join us by emailing think@kera.org or by calling 1-800-933-5372. Elizabeth, many people, of course, see their good works and their donations to charity as a means of glorifying God. Is there a relationship between religious faith and an inclination toward self-sacrifice?
There may be. That's something that I decided to kind of steer clear of the whole issue of, you know, whether there are certain faiths that promote this or not. But there are some studies showing that there may be certain areas of the brain that if you have a certain kind of mindset that inclines you to help other people, that certain areas of the brain look different than if you're somebody who's more selfish. And certainly there are certain types of religious thought that do very highly value serving other people. And so that could be something that, if that works for you in your life, could help you along your journey to becoming more selfless.
That's interesting. So it might actually, that tendency in the brain might draw one to religion as much as the tenets of religion might propel someone to do good works.
Right, right. I mean, I think that, you know, ultimately a lot of religions, like what we value, comes out of what works for us as humans. And, you know, if we value selflessness, if we see that that benefits us as a society, like that oftentimes will become ingrained into the fabric of our culture, into our religions.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's speak next with Becky in Arlington. Hello, Becky.
Hello, Chris. Thanks so much for taking my call.
Sure.
Elizabeth, I love the empowering message that you're bringing today. And I just wanted to ask you, I'm currently a nursing student looking at emergency or trauma medicine. And I wanted to know some practical tips from you, whether it's for the brain specifically or just for a lifestyle, to preventing burnout and being a successful, sustainable, everyday hero.
Right. Yeah, that's a very good question, especially in a high-stress career like the one that you're considering. I mean, we find with frequent volunteers, too, that in order to avoid burnout, you need to step back and assess, how much am I getting out of this activity? How much is it adding to my life versus how much is it detracting from my relationships with family members, perhaps other aspects of life that, if you're not careful, can get overshadowed. And, that can go for either career or for volunteer pursuits. So I think, part of it comes down to just having a really honest interior discussion with yourself. What do I really value and what do I want to make sure that I maintain in my life? And that can help you come up with a good balance and make sure that all the areas that you value the most get their proper due.
What did you learn about the relationship between suffering and loss and an interest in helping other people?
Yeah, that was actually one of my favorite chapters in the book to write. Interestingly, there are actually studies that show that when we go through some sort of traumatic experience, like a violent assault, or perhaps we've survived a natural disaster, that we're possibly more likely to feel sympathy for other people who might be going through their own tough times. There was one study where people who had gone through certain types of suffering were more likely to say that they would donate to victims of an Asian tsunami. It might seem kind of counterintuitive at first because you might say, well, wouldn't going through these kind of hard experiences sort of make you shut down or turn bitter? And I think it can. I think we need to acknowledge that sometimes that's what happens. But I think what it comes down to as well is that it is our choice how we respond to some of these difficult things that we face in life. I talk in my book about a really courageous woman named Jody Blanco, who was horribly bullied when she was growing up. She was physically assaulted. She was called horrible names by the other students at her school. She actually used to eat her lunch in the bathroom because she knew people weren't going to let her sit with them in the cafeteria. And ultimately, she survived that whole awful experience. She grew up to be very successful in the publishing world. And then later on, she decided that, hey, I'm going to devote myself to helping other bullied kids who suffered the way that I suffered when I was younger. And so now she runs these workshops that are called It's Not Just Joking Around, talking about bullying. And she talks to kids at schools all over the country about what kind of impact bullying can really have on a victim's life and why it is so important to treat other people with respect. And what she told me is that, honestly, if I hadn't gone through some of these tough experiences growing up, it probably might not have become my mission in life to help bullied students the way I do now. So, if there is a silver lining to the difficulties that we face in life, it's that, at times we can turn our pain and the difficult things we go through into a gift to others if we use it to access our empathy for them and to help them get through some of the similar things like we went through.
Yeah. Has anybody looked into whether there's a direct correlation between having suffered some kind of trauma and a growth in empathy that sort of sticks with a person?
Yeah, I mean, I think what the studies show is that this growth in empathy does stick with you. And certainly the people that I talk to, their own lives seem to bear that out. One of the researchers that's done some of this work about altruism born of suffering, he actually he grew up in Europe during World War II. He was a Jewish child, and it ended up that he was saved from deportation to one of the camps, but he went through a lot of tough times. He endured a lot of discrimination, but then there were some people that helped him and his family. There was a woman who actually brought them food, a Christian woman, probably at risk to her own life. And so, yeah, he was very interested in this question of, you know, and then he went on to become a researcher into altruism and to publish papers that were very helpful to people all over the world in shedding light on this issue. So, you know, to me, his life is an example of somebody who went through suffering, and then he was compelled to help other people later in life, basically to make himself of service.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's speak next on the phone with Stephen. Hello, Stephen.
Hey.
Hi. Go right ahead, please.
Yeah, I just had a question about, in this case, it would pertain to police officers. Mm-hmm. How I would see some people was, you know, trained for the worst and hope that something never ever would happen to them.
Right.
And they're ready to take on that responsibility. And then there's people that are just throwing themselves into danger, whatever the outcome. They don't care about the person's life. They just want to do it. Can you explain that?
Huh. Interesting question.
Right. Well, can you explain exactly what you mean, the distinction between, okay, so there are people who are trained, like the police officers, and then are you saying there are people who don't care about what happens to them, like they have no regard for their personal safety?
They don't have regards for the other person. They just want to do it for the danger. They're not really...
Oh, yeah, like for the adrenaline rush of it. You know, I mean, I think that's possible in some cases. I'm not sure if there's been a study that's broken down, okay, you know, these are people that truly did it for selfless reasons versus these are people who are just adrenaline junkies and they would have done it regardless. But that's an interesting question. You know, it's something I hope somebody will investigate in the future. I just haven't heard any specific studies that exist along those lines.
It didn't really come up in the book, but the book made me think about sort of the line between perceived heroism and then what can turn into vigilantism and sort of how you mm-hmm. ensure that you're making the right decision for the right reason.
Yes, I think that's very important, and that's something that Dr. Zimbardo likes to emphasize because, you know, sometimes people will say to him, well, are you encouraging people to be foolhardy and, you know, to put themselves at risk unnecessarily? And he says, you know, no, an important part of training yourself to be a hero involves using this kind of good judgment. Does it really make sense for me to intervene in the situation? You know, if you try to stop a robber who's holding somebody up at a convenience store, you know, maybe you would get killed yourself, and maybe just depending on how you assess the situation, it might be more prudent for you to call 911 or try to alert a police officer or somebody else in the vicinity. It's not always the case that the best choice is to intervene yourself. So it is a complex issue, and this is something that definitely will come up when you talk to heroism researchers.
Back to the phones now. This time we have Claire on the line in Dallas. Hey, Claire.
Hi. I just wanted to say thank you for the conversation, and I wanted to comment regarding preparation that sometimes a strong focus on your interests or your work at the time may at one point be considered selfish by some others, but it may provide the knowledge and skills that allow you to act selflessly down the road.
Hmm. Yeah, I think that's a very good point. And, you know, we see that in perhaps like pilots who go through years and years of training to reach the level of expertise that they do, and they may have to spend quite a bit of time away from their families, away from their friends. But as a result of that, you know, sometimes we get these really selfless acts. You may have heard a few years back, Chesley Sullenberger, the U.S. Airways pilot, who after both of his passenger plane's engines were knocked out by birds that that ran into them, he was then able to draw upon his expertise to basically land the plane as if it were a glider onto the Hudson River. And he landed the plane safely. He made sure that all the passengers got out before he did, and as a result, everybody was safe. So I think that's really an example of where, you know, having what, as you say, might seem like this selfish focus to some can ultimately pay off with dividends in, you know, being very selfish, selfless later on.
What does it take to train ourselves to intervene when it might not necessarily be a situation where physical harm will come to us, but to sort of stand up for somebody who's being bullied or disrespected? Because it's often easier to stand by and not participate, but not actively sort of put ourselves socially at risk.
Yeah, I think that's a very good question, because I think a lot of us face these scenarios every day, especially in the corporate environment. And there are some interesting strategies that are being used to empower people at work who might be scared about raising ethical concerns. For instance, like if somebody you work with did something like hacking into a secure database that you consider unethical, but you know, let's say you know that this person is a friend of the boss and you're afraid of how the boss might react. You know, are they going to tell you that you're wrong? Are you going to get branded a snitch or blamed somehow? So maybe you would decide just not to say anything about it because you're afraid of what's going to happen. So the technique that the psychologist Lynn Henderson is using to help people confront these kind of concerns is to actually help them role play these incidents and do a kind of rehearsal where maybe, you know, one person is playing the intervener, the person who's thinking about what to do. Another person might play the boss, and somebody else might play the other employee. And what people often find when they do these types of rehearsals is that, well, it's not quite as scary to speak up as they thought it might be. And, you know, the results that they get are better, and usually these worst-case scenarios, like I'm going to get fired, I'm going to get ostracized, don't come to pass. And having that knowledge that they gain through rehearsal, then when they encounter a real-life situation like that, they can more easily take charge of the situation and, you know, behave according to their morals instead of letting the fear take precedence.
Elizabeth Svoboda is a journalist who's written for publications including Popular Science, Discover, Psychology Today, and The New York Times. Her new book is called What Makes a Hero? The Surprising Science of Selflessness. Elizabeth, it's been a really interesting hour. Thank you so much for making time for us.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been great.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Our podcast is produced by Christine McConnell. We had Christina Martinez on phones today. Lindsay Connect produced the show, and Jeff Whittington is executive producer. You can learn more about the show, find out about upcoming programs, and download the podcast free at kera.org/think. We always welcome your comments, questions, and suggestions as well. You can email them to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.